God, we thank you again for this incredible book and for its power to speak to us thousands of years after it was written. We know that power is so because of the work of the Holy Spirit. And so we welcome you, we invite you to be with us this evening, Lord, not as an intruder, but as the King. Come and speak, come and be in authority, come take possession of our lives. I pray, Lord, that your hand would be moving across the room, touching hearts, touching minds here and there, causing people to think differently as this book does its work. Lord, please draw near to people. I pray for the miracle of new birth this evening, the miracle of God speaking to hearts that are without him and to hearts that know God but need encouragement, need a challenge, need to see perspective once again. Need to be learning about contentment in God instead of chasing after wind. We say, come God and speak to us this evening in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Well, Solomon, the wisest, most wealthy, most powerful person, certainly that Israel had ever seen, is going through, you could call it some kind of midlife crisis. It seems to me he's at the end of his life. He's evaluating his life. He's looking at what he's done. He's looking at what he's achieved, and he's thinking what there has been that he's gained from it. What has he really got out of it that lasts? And last week, we looked very carefully at his very blunt first chapter, where he is extremely bleak about the absence of any real meaning and point and fulfillment in life. And the fact that life seems to go around in circles, it seems to just have no clear direction, it seems to have no purpose that you can discern. It's just kind of an ongoing rambling of random arbitrary events, and it all kind of adds up to nothing. No particularly big change takes place. All the changes that happen are tiny, tiny changes, nothing really substantial. And he ends up in that chapter saying, well, look, even all my wisdom has got me nowhere. Even my learning, being the wisest man in the world, ultimately gave me nothing for itself. Because my wisdom taught me one thing in the end, and that was that there was nothing to learn. There's nothing new under the sun. Life is still hebel. Hebel's the Hebrew word. It means vapor, mist, steam, smoke. It's something that just is there and it's gone. You can't harness it. You cannot shepherd it. You can't control it. You can't cause it to last any longer. It's gone. And the best things that Solomon saw in life just seemed to disappear. And so all his wisdom taught him was that life is indeed a vapor. Vanity, which is the word in the English translation, which most of you will have come across. Vanity of vanities. Well, in this second chapter, he's kind of saying, right, okay, I've tried wisdom to give me meaning. I've tried to learn. But what I'm going to do now is try the alternative. I'm going to try and not learn. And try and just experience. I'm just going to look for any conceivable experience of pleasure that the world has to offer as a way of seeing if there's anything meaningful under the sun. I said in my heart, verse 1, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. So it's a test. It's a kind of experiment. We might call it the pleasure experiment. Solomon embarks on this pleasure experiment for the first part of this chapter here. Why is he doing that? Well, he's wanting to show us life from a secular perspective. A secular perspective. Now, you might have not been used to the word. Don't be scared. It just means living as if God is not there. That's really what to be secular means. If someone is a secularist, it means they live or they think as if God is not really there. And you can be a church-going secularist. I dare say there are people in this room who go to church regularly but are still basically secularist, because your attendance of church, it says one thing, but the basic way in which you live your life is suggests that God isn't really there. Or if he or she or it is there, then there's no real bearing on reality. It doesn't make any difference to my life, this God, this vague idea of God. And generally, that's the way that the culture around us tends to think about God, that if there is such a kind of beyond the sun being, that's where he stays. And so it doesn't really make any difference if there's a God or not, really, to the realities of life, to the challenges and the desires and longings and visions and hopes and dreams that we have. Well, God doesn't seem to show up much. And when he does, it's just the exception that proves the rule. He's just not relevant, or it is not relevant. And Solomon's assuming that position. He's saying, let's just see what that leads to. He has a lot of authority to say this, because he, of all people, experimented the most. He knows the secular worldview from the inside. He's done it. He has done life under the sun. He has done life under the sun, if anyone ever has. I mean, he had brain power, political power, and economic power beyond the wildest dreams of anybody in this room or anybody in this city. So he says, with all my resources, I am going to go on an experiment and try pleasure out. See what I can get. So I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? And that's the verdict he's going to come to. But let's go with him first through the process of finding out. I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine. My heart still guiding me with wisdom. So he's still kind of in his right mind in the sense that he's doing an experiment. I dare say he was out of his mind quite a lot. Cheering my body with wine. He could afford a lot of it. And it wasn't grape juice, it was wine. Solomon was into wine. And how to lay hold on folly. The opposite of wisdom. Just getting experience. Going wild. Fresh as week. Solomon did fresh as week big time. He went to Brighton University or Sussex University. He went to the party town. That's what Brighton is. And maybe you're here for the first time because you're a student that's just showed up in Brighton. And you know what Brighton is supposed to be like. And you said to people, well, I really want to go to Sussex University because that course looks really, really, really special. And they said, yeah, they do the same course at Hull. He said, well, you're kind of the same. There's just a few, it's just not quite the course that I want. It's not quite the course. Because I want to go to Brighton and get drunk. And that's the way people think about this city. That is actually the way much of the economy is set up of this city, isn't it, basically? The party town. Solomon knew how to party. To be honest, though, Solomon is probably better at it than anyone here. It says in the Bible that he would throw parties every night. He could throw parties that would feed enough people to put meals in front of 35,000 people. So Solomon threw parties for small towns, basically. Every night. Night after night. So, I mean, your barbecue in the summer, in the back garden with your half-cooked burger and your half-warm glass of Cabernet Sauvignon with yesterday's Pringles, you know, floating around the top. That's Solomon's. I went a bit further than that. I really, really indulged. I got very, very drunk. I got very stoned. I woke up in places you wouldn't dream of. He's done it. He knows what he's talking about when it comes to pleasure. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. So after a while with the parties, he thought, well, I'd better make a name for myself at least. So he started to build things, big, big things. Big parks, big homes, big palaces, big houses, big gardens, big vineyards. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had ever been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers. See, so I get CDs. I get downloads. Solomon got singers. He didn't say, I think I might try and catch that band at the Comedia this week. I might try and pop in on that. He said, do you know what? I think I'll buy the Comedia. That makes life a lot easier. He's listening to radio, thinking, oh, that song comes on. That's quite good. What band is this? They're called Oasis. Okay, we'll buy them. That's what it was like. Oh, I had singers. Yeah, I'll have them in the house, please. They can wake me up. He had concubines. Many concubines. The delight of the children of man. It's probable that the true translation of that verse is slightly more obscene than that. I won't go into what it is, but you probably don't need me to go into what it is. Concubines. That means women who came with no connections. He had 300 of them, actually. 300 concubines. So Solomon didn't have to go home and click on a website. He didn't have to go on the pay-per-view channel or go and buy a magazine from the top shelf. He went 25,000 miles further than that. He had the women brought to him. And he indulged every sexual fantasy that his lustful mind could invent. He tried it everything. He went the whole way. And what does he have to say? I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. He was famous, respected, taken very seriously, highly regarded by his contemporaries. People came from across the world to listen, sit at his feet. Monarchs, the Queen of Sheba, came to visit because she heard of his great wisdom. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from pleasure, from no pleasure. For my heart found pleasure in all my toil. And this was my reward for all my toil. So you say, yeah, it was pleasurable. Oh, yeah, there was some pleasure. I'm not going to lie to you. There were some moments that was fun. Some fun there. What does he say as the final summary of the whole thing? Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it. Listen to this. And behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind. There was nothing to be gained. There was nothing to be gained. Nothing of lasting value. It was vanity. It left a bad taste in the mouth. It's like when you pour a great glass of wine and you bring it to your lips and it's just sawdust. It's like, what happened? I can't appreciate this. There's nothing to be gained. And the more I drank, the more I slept with, the more I pursued, the more I bought and controlled and built, the more unsatisfied I was. Because I was striving after the wind. You cannot control. Nothing there. He says, I considered. See, some of us never ever get to verse 11. We never stop and consider. Maybe some of you have never really considered what your life is about. If what you've been pursuing all your life is really that worth it. There's a beautiful phrase in Luke 15 where Jesus is telling a story about a young man who leaves his father, takes all the wealth, says, I want my inheritance now. I want what the world has now. I want it. I want it. I want it. Goes out, spends it on wild living, prostitutes, drink, parties, everything he can get his hands on. And it comes to the point where after all of his exhausting pursuit of pleasure, it says this, he came to himself. Came to himself. It's like he looked inside and thought, what have I become? What difference has this made to me? Some translations say, he came to his senses. Have you done that? Really, have you done that? why this book is so precious. Solomon did it all, and he stopped and considered and was honest enough to say, it is worth nothing. Nothing. He's saying, trust me. Please believe me. Don't go that way. He's not even saying it on moralistic terms. Have you noticed? He says, I'll read it to you. All was vanity and striving after the wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. Which perspective is he looking from? Is he looking from a heavenly, religious, moralistic perspective, or looking from a secular perspective? A secular one. He's still looking from under the sun. He's still saying, even from under the sun, there's nothing to be gained. Even if you look at it from that, even if you assume there's no God, there's no heaven, there's no hell, doesn't matter what happens to me. It doesn't matter. I'm assuming that there's no meaning to life, and I'm going to pursue pleasure as a means of trying to find fulfillment. And what do I find? It is empty. It really is. There's nothing there. So he's not saying, please listen, because this is the thing. Many of you, maybe you've come from religious backgrounds, or you went to a church school, or you went to school assemblies, and they prayed prayers and told you, God's nice and lovely, and then told you off. And you thought, well, I don't quite understand. Presumably God likes me, but presumably also God is unpleasant to be around. And you're used to the idea that Christianity, the message of Jesus, is basically, well, we know that you could go and have lots of fun. There is fun out there. There's lots of fun, lots of lovely, pleasurable, exciting things, which we don't really talk about because they're so revolting. You shouldn't do those things because they're bad. You should have God. So there's either fun or there's God. That's the choice that we... This is the choice. Please listen to me, right? Look at me. This is the choice that you feel you've had to make through your life, most of you. It's either I actually find joy and peace and fulfillment, or I have God. And if that's how you feel, I kind of understand. I kind of don't blame you if you like. At least I can understand why you might have made choices to depart from the path. Because why would you want that? It just seems so miserable. But Solomon isn't arguing. He's not saying, look, I always vanity and strive after the wind, and there was nothing to be gained because it was naughty. I enjoyed it all, but I realized I've been a bad boy. I've been a very bad boy. So I came home and apologized, did my homework, did some chores in the house. He says it was nothing under the sun. Even from that point of view, it was bogus. There's nothing ultimately useful about it. And you might think, well, I'm different to Solomon. This is the temptation that you have, right? This is what we all think. Well, Solomon, okay, he did an experiment, but at least I should try an experiment as well. Give me a chance. I mean, he did it. That's what his results. I might get different results. But that's not how it works. Is it? You know, when you do science lessons, if you ever did them, you would have known that they had... You had to describe the method, you had to describe the apparatus and all the different things that you did. And the result was just the result. The result was the result. Water boils at 100 degrees centigrade for everybody or thereabouts. It's not like someone can say, well, in my laboratory, it boils at 200. Yeah. Now, Solomon is doing the definitive experiment on does pleasure give us fulfillment? God has been kind enough to you to put it in this book. So you don't have to. You don't. You just trust him. You think, well, yeah, but I would be different. I would really, if I won the lottery, if I won £24 million, I would be sensible with it. I would do something wise with it. I would find fulfillment. Give me a chance to have that many concubines. I would find real pleasure in it, and it would be fulfilling. And wise and sensible. I would be a sensible concubine addict. You can trust me. I'll be different. And Solomon says, give me a break. This is the result. The jury's in. I'll prove it to you. When you see, we all go for things. We all go for things that we pursue through life that we think will give us joy, fulfillment, and lasting peace and happiness. We do. This is the way we're made. God made you that way. And if you've ever been in love with somebody and wanted to marry them, you'll know what I mean. And if you wanted to marry someone enough, you will understand the lottery is just money. Loads of concubines is just meaningless experience. Alcohol and drugs are kind of pointless because I'm in love with someone. I see that as the only thing worth having. That was how it was for me when I first met my wife. I met her. I just watched her from a distance. I'm not a stalker, don't worry. That's not what it was like. In the summer of, I think it was 1996, the first time I saw her, I spoke to her for the first time 12 months later. This was long-term, long, slow progress. I was serious about her 12 months later. And 12 months after that, we started going out. And 15 months after that, we got married. This is years of hard work. Focusing. Got to have that woman. Got to have that one. That one. That's the one I want. Years. There were several other, distractions, but they're just not interesting to me. Because I wanted her. 12 months. I didn't even speak to her for the first year. And when we did start speaking a year later, our conversations basically consisted of me going, slow, slow progress. If you said to me during that time, those 3 years, if you said to me, you can either have 24 million, the lottery jackpot, or you can have Kate. I hope you'll believe me when I say, non-issue. Non-issue. I don't need money. This woman is what I'm after. She was my lottery ticket. She was what I wanted. She's the thing that was going to, this was it. This is the thing I want. Now, we've been married for 9 years, next 2-3 weeks. I said this morning, she said to me on the way home, she said, it sounded like you were going to say, I wish I'd gone for the 24 million. What I am going to say is this. Our marriage is great, and it does get better every year. It's not easy, but it does get better. But it's not it. It's not it. The thing that I was longing for, it's still not it. There is an it that you are made for. You see, in Romeo and Juliet, the RSC are going to bring Romeo and Juliet down here soon, and there's that line where Juliet says about Romeo, he is the god of my idolatry. The god of my idolatry. She worships him because he is what life is suddenly all about. As Solomon would tell you, I would tell you, even a great marriage is not it. And the reason why is actually given away in the next chapter, in verse 11 of chapter 3, where Solomon says, you've set eternity in our hearts. God has put something inside you that will only be satisfied by the eternal. And so all of your longings become a chasing after vapor, because vapor is the definition of something that's just temporal. It goes, it diminishes, it stops, it's fleeting, it's passing. You can enjoy it, but it's suddenly not there anymore. And the things you pursue, say, that will give me pleasure and lasting pleasure. You know eventually it won't. Because this, you were made for eternity. If you just live as a creature of instinct, you're not really being human. You're not really being true to how God made you. There's a longing for something far more substantial. So he's arguing on your terms. He's saying, look, I know what you mean. You think you're going to find pleasure. I've done it. I've been there. It didn't work. And you know as well if you're honest. And then he says, well, look, okay, I've tried wisdom now and and I've tried pleasure. I've tried wisdom, and I've tried folly, if you like. And he starts to say, well, look, there is something to be said after all of this experimenting for wisdom, for sure. There's more gain in wisdom than in folly, verse 13. As there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. So yeah, wisdom's got some value. There's something good about wisdom, for sure. It's better to be wise. It's not good to be stupid. The Bible doesn't commend stupidity. Many people think it does. That's why books like Tim Keller's are so important, that we understand that Christianity stands on its own two feet intellectually. It makes sense. Solomon says, yeah, wisdom's a good thing. The Bible's in favor of being intelligent, thinking about life, and not just being blind and walking around with your eyes closed and your pants down. So that's not good enough. That's not the way to live for anybody. Sure, there's actually some wisdom here, and it's good. But the wise person has eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness, and yet I perceive that, oh boy, the same event happens to all of them. What's he talking about? I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. We're all going to die. We're all going to die. Now, I know that's not particularly pleasant news, and it's not something we spend time meditating on in 21st century Brighton. It's a bit Victorian to talk about death. See, the Victorians talked about death all the time and never talked about sex. We talk about sex all the time and never talk about death. Because death is the 21st century pornography. Don't talk about death, except in a kind of half-joking way. Bible's much more honest about death. It really wants us to think about it. God is kind enough to remind us that we're going to die. Death seems to be no respecter of persons. The death rate is still 100%. The wisest people die, and the stupidest people die, and death respects neither. Death says, great, you got a first in your degree. How interesting. Your time is up. You won a Nobel Prize. Well done, well done. Who cares? Who cares? Death is the ultimate leveler. Brings everybody down. And it levels all of our kind of, I guess, proud ideas of what is valuable and what is not valuable. Maybe they're not proud. Maybe they're virtuous. Maybe they're right. Maybe we're right when we think that Jane Austen is higher culture than Jerry Springer. Yeah, we're probably right. But death doesn't care. They all go the same way in the end. That's what he's saying here. Why then have I been so very wise? Verse 16. Of the wise as of the fool there is no enduring remembrance. Seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. So I understand that much of life is vanity. I agree with you. I watch, you know, ITV on Saturday night and I think this is cheap, cheesy entertainment. I think it's feeble. There's nothing to it. There's nothing lasting to X Factor, and there's nothing substantial to it. It's going to pass away. I hear the pop tunes on the radio and I think, well, there's only three chords to this song. And the words are all about lovey-dovey stuff. There's nothing substantial. It's just some producers in studios making a lot of money out of vaguely attractive young people who make songs that someone made 20 years ago. Pathetic. Pish. See, I prefer proper classical art. Culture. They like Girls Aloud. I like Stravinsky. I understand Matisse and Strindberg. I understand Plato. Yeah, but death doesn't care. But please, I know that's not nice to hear, and maybe I should be behind the bulletproof screen. It's true, isn't it? In the end, it means nothing. Our high art, if we say that there is only what's under the sun, which people are saying, and maybe that's how you're living. And you have to admit it, even the things that you see as valuable are valueless, because death comes in with a big scythe and says you're all going down, and no one will remember you anyway. And if they do, so what? You won't be around to enjoy that. And they won't remember you anyway. They might remember you, but most of you, no one will remember you. That's the way death talks. How the wise dies just like the fool. This is true, isn't it? You go to an undertaker, you ask him, he'll tell you. He spends his life burying people. It's all very samey. Go to the graveside, lower them into the ground, put some earth over them. Maybe they get cremated, a little different, same basic result. They're gone. And we say a few words. We say some words about what they were like. And then we go home and eat potato salad. And we've only got so much time to talk about what they were like. We've got lives, you know, we're busy. So we pick out a few highlights. Maybe they were very virtuous people. Maybe they were very special. Maybe they were Mahatma Gandhi. Maybe they were Nelson Mandela. Maybe they were, I don't know, you name it. But we've only got so much time. We can't spend our lives eulogizing about the dead. We've got stuff to do. We're striving. We're under the sun. We're busy. We're chasing the wind. So let's make it quick, please. Yeah, he was a good guy. Great. Well done. Then someone else comes up to the graveside, and he was a complete idiot. Just totally irresponsible. Left his wife and kids, destroyed people's lives, wasted his money, wasted his life. But no one can stand to speak ill of them at the graveside. So we say nice things about them. We pick out a few. We've got 15 minutes. Right, let's fill 15 minutes up with nice things about them. He knew how to laugh. He knew how to have a good time. Yeah, he meant well. Yeah, he left his wife, but he meant well. He said sorry. Let's put a few nice things. Yeah, he was a good guy. Yeah, he was a great guy. We'll miss him. He was a great guy. Right, let's go home. And the undertaker will say, pretty much the same story for both. You look at the obituary columns. They pull out the best things for the best. And they can only do so many of the good things. And they pull out the best things of the worst. Just enough to fill up a few columns. The wise dies like the fool. So death doesn't help. Death says, even wisdom becomes meaningless and valueless. And he says, just to rub salt in the wound. He says, who knows, verse 19, whether he will be a wise or a fool. I hated all my toil in which I toiled under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. I've worked hard, I've done well, I've built an empire, I've built a kingdom, I've done extremely well. And I'm going to hand it over to the next generation. He might be a complete idiot. So the more you achieve in this life, the more you've got to worry about. The more passionate you are about some great achievement, all you're going to do is hand over to someone and he might be a complete failure. He might be the worst jerk on the planet. And you just walk away or you die thinking, well, who knows what's going to happen? Who knows? This is a very real issue. Who knows what's going to happen to our inheritance, to all that we've done, all that we've achieved in our life? What is it? It's going up in smoke. Well, the guy might do well with it, but we just don't know. We don't know what's going to happen. This is the reality. I mean, he's facing the facts so squarely. He's been so helpful. Friends, I'm trying to be helpful because if you don't think this way, you'll always be walking in self-delusion. You'll just be doing a spray paint job over your life. And Solomon's refusing to say, no, 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 no. Be honest. Death means that we don't really know what's going to happen in the end. We just don't. Under the sun, there's no way to know, to be sure. So the best things are, just hand them over to, I don't know, we'll hand it over to the right guy. Hopefully we'll spend time considering who that should be and really working hard and deciding carefully. In Solomon's case, he handed it over to his son, Rehoboam, who turned out to be, yes, a complete disaster. He was an idiot. He halved the kingdom, and from that time onwards, Israel's history was ruined. Solomon handed it all over to his idiot son. rubs salt in the wound, isn't it? Who knows what's going to happen? Who knows what's going to happen with all the things I've cherished? I've built up my family. I've got married, raised kids. They're wonderful kids. What's going to happen to them? It's going to be another 9/11? What's going to happen to my pension? Bradford and Bingley got nationalised. That kind of brought it home. It's not just the city banks. It's some of the high street. This could be... What about my mortgage? What kind of country are we going to be living in? Solomon says, who knows? He doesn't jump in with a quick, it's all right, it's going to be all right, it's going to be fine, it's going to be okay. Just believe the best and everything will be good. Just think positive, happy thoughts. Who knows? That's where you have to go if you're living under the sun. Really, who knows? Just hope for the best. So what do? You just try and drift through life, trying to enjoy it as much as you possibly can. If only I could just have a bit of fun in my life. And people do that. People say, well, let's just gamble with our lives. Just try and enjoy it a little bit. And occasionally we have this fleeting moment where we look at the horrible emptiness of the world. We're confronted with it to our eyeballs. And we look away quickly. We look away quickly. Anything to take away the pain of reality. Yeah, I went to church that evening, and that preacher, he really, really needs to get out more. He is just, oh man, that guy, what is wrong with him? What music has he been listening to? So we got to church. Yeah, it made me think. Yeah, I thought about eternity. Horrible. And I went out and went to the pub. And now I feel better. You don't really feel better. You just glazed over it. You've just taken some kind of drug. Not necessarily a real drug, but just the drug of self-delusion and denial. Everyone is doing this. The guys that write the songs that say this most honestly then have to go away and write a song quickly about lovey-dovey things to make themselves feel better. That's why that guy, Sam Sparrow, that wrote that song, Black and Gold, He said, I just had this mood, it came over me, I wrote it. You look at the words, I know it sounds like a cheesy chart song, but if you look at the words, he's saying, it's like Ecclesiastes. And he says, I don't know what came over me, I just wrote the song, I just thought about it for a little while, and yeah, that was in the past. Chris Martin from Coldplay said the same thing, I read it recently, he said, yeah, I don't know what's going to happen with all my songs or my albums, who knows, it's all going to be gone, puff of smoke, one day it will all disappear. So I just get on with being busy. Just get on with life. I understand that. I guess that's what we all do in a way, but Solomon won't let you go there. The reason he's being such a pain is because he has a better answer. He's got better news for you. Let's look at what he says in verse 24. Listen carefully. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he's given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give it to the one who pleases God. This is a change of tone, isn't it? This really is. This is where Solomon suddenly changes the tone of the book. Through the book, you get a few more points. We'll read it. We will learn as we go through. There's places where Solomon suddenly comes in with answers. And you can, if you blink, you miss them. You don't realize it. And you read the whole book, you think, man, that was miserable. You read it with your eyes open, you see he's saying something very, very different. Very different. What's he saying here? Well, let me say it as simply, clearly, as quickly as I can. He's saying this. Yes, there is eternal joy. There's joy, there's wisdom, there's knowledge. That really means something. Not just knowledge about life, but the knowledge of God. Yes, there's joy, lasting joy, but you cannot have it, it says here, apart from him. Apart from him, verse 25, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? So yeah, God made you to enjoy life with him. He made you to genuinely enjoy, not to curse it and say like he says here, I hated life. doesn't want that to be written over you. He says, no, there's joy to be had. God desires that we should rejoice in our lives. He put man and woman in a garden, which he prepared for them. And he said, enjoy it. Enjoy one another. Enjoy sex. Enjoy creation. Enjoy the fruit of the forest. Enjoy. Have fun. This is a game of pleasure for you. I've made you for it. But without him, who can eat and drink? From the beginning, we have been stupid enough to try eating and drinking the thing we're not supposed to eat and drink. Trying to find fulfillment without God. Like Adam wanting the apple or the fruit from the tree that wasn't his. The one thing. God gives him a whole garden, a whole planet. But he has to have the one thing, the one tree. That's the story of our lives. Solomon builds great gardens like the Garden of Eden, but doesn't want God in it. Builds a paradise. That's what the word means in the Hebrew. A great paradise, a garden in verse 5. Like a secular Eden. Many of us are trying to build our secular Edens, our godless paradises, our lives where we will be happy without God. And he's saying, you cannot do it. You cannot have enjoyment without him. And that's the problem. The more you pursue it, the more exhausted you get. The more you're like the sinner who is given the business of gathering and collecting. It doesn't even say what they're gathering and collecting. It just says gathering and collecting. A lifestyle of gathering, collecting, and never having anything left over. There's no gain under the sun. I'm just trying to find happiness, and I can't really find it. And the reason why is because I'm looking in the wrong place. I've forgotten that you cannot have it except from the hand of God who gives gifts. Because he's generous. He's so generous. Listen, this is the news that will change the whole outlook for Solomon. This is the way he comes through. And this is the way you can come through tonight. You, right here in your seat this evening, can come through to a place where you know in your heart there are answers. There's truth. There's joy. There's meaning that is eternal. And it's by saying, I'm not going to keep pursuing answers through these fruitless means. I'm going to be content in the gift of God. The gift of God. God is lavish. He gives gifts. He gives gifts, but we have to chase the ones he hasn't given. You know exactly what I'm talking about. Things that you feel you must have. You must be. God says, I want to give you things. It's a gift of God. Have you received the gift of God? Are you receiving the gift of God? And look, it says it sounds kind of almost a little bit shallow. Eating and drinking, he says. But listen, that's the point he's making. Enjoying this life, not just the next life, but in this life, to enjoy it fully, you need to do it under the oversight of the one who lives beyond the sun. You need to live in the light of him, not just under the sun. You need to be able to say, I thank you, God. People are miserable because they kind of enjoy life, but they don't know how to, because they don't know how to give thanks for it. They don't know how to say thank you. They don't know who to thank. But if you can receive, food and drink with your best friends, with your family, and at the end of it say, God, I thank you for all of it. I thank you for giving these gifts. You're on your way to finding contentment. Because you're receiving them from the hand of God. You're not snatching them. You're saying, God, I receive it as a gift. You're kind. You're generous to me. God wants to be generous to you. He's got a plan for you. He's got desires for you. He wants to give things into your lap, spilling over and over and over into other people's lives as well. But that won't happen if you're only pursuing things that are not for you. So the way to actually find enjoyment, or as Paul puts it in Philippians 4, contentment is through Jesus Christ. See, this is the last thing I want to say before we close, and maybe the band could come and join me in just a moment before we finish here. Just perhaps wait a second, I'll ask you up just in a moment. But he says this, God has given wisdom, knowledge, and joy, but to the sinner he's given the business of gathering and collecting. See, for sinful people, there's no reward, there's just toil. Gathering, collecting, big busy, trying to find answers. But that's very, very bad news, because the same guy says in the same book, just a few pages later, in chapter 7, All people, all of us are sinful. There's no one on the planet who hasn't sinned. We're all sinners, actually. So the sinner, verse 20, surely there is no righteous man, chapter 7, verse 20, on earth who does good and never sins. So that puts us all in the position of this man that's striving after the wind. You and I, friends, all of us, be honest, please. We, all of us, have pursued things that are not for us. We've pursued things that are not God's will for us. We've lived as if there's no God. We've lived under the sun. We've lived in a secular way. We're sinners, all of us. We can't please God. He says, to the one that pleases God, there's enjoyment. But we can't. We've sinned. We are not pleasing God. So what does God do? God sends someone who pleases him perfectly. And God allows him to be our substitute. Jesus Christ pleased God 24/7 all his life. God was so pleased with him, he couldn't help shouting it out from the rooftops of heaven when Jesus was baptized. This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. But when Jesus was crucified upon the cross, God was very displeased with him. Because of something he'd done? No. Because of stuff I'd done. Because of stuff you'd done. Jesus took your shame, guilt, sin, evil thoughts, bad language, stupid decisions, evil desires. He suffered for them on the cross. So that you, by his gift, his free gift, could please God. That's what the cross is all about. And tonight, what we want to offer you is not just a lesson in why life is meaningless, but a lesson in why life can have meaning and hope and joy, actually. Knowing that your sins are forgiven, you can please God. Not by saying, I will try harder to be a good Christian. That's just as much of a striving after the wind. That's useless. But by receiving the gift of God, the free gift of God, saying, by faith, I choose to believe that Jesus saved me through his blood. Because of faith, you please God. It says in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6, without faith, it's impossible to please God. You believe in Jesus. Say, Jesus, I'm going to trust you. I trust you for my life in this life. I'm going to trust you for my life in the next. I'm not going to spend my life chasing the wind, striving after things that don't deliver. I'm going to spend my life trusting in your gift for me and becoming your friend.